evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, March 22nd, 2019. A high-ranking Vatican official pays a visit to South Sudan.
We have various meetings with leaders of the country and also with members of the churches, Christian churches. Not exactly a fact-finding mission, but to put some faces to the things that we read in reports and we see on in the media.
An ICRC tracing program in South Sudan is reuniting families.
Some of them, they are still in the POC, and then they did not say that we are coming outside in order to stay here. Some of them, they want to come out, but majority their houses have been destroyed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Senior Vatican official is in South Sudan for a five-day visit. The Secretary for Relations with States at the Holy See arrived in Juba on Thursday and is scheduled to meet with several government and opposition officials during his visit. Onen Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
Archbishop Paul Richard Gallagher says he is in South Sudan on behalf of Pope Francis and the Vatican's Secretary of State, Pietro Parolin, to encourage the warring parties to work together in addressing the challenges that lie before them in building peace across the country.
And to see in what ways South Sudan and the Holy See can cooperate. The mission of the Pope is always that of bringing unity. It is a question of bringing communion amongst Catholics and Christians everywhere, to work on unity, to work on making progress, to overcome obstacles to anything that separates us.
Pope Francis welcomed President Salva Kiir on March 16th to the Vatican, where the two leaders discussed implementation of the September 12 revitalized peace deal and how to end violence in South Sudan. Archbishop Gallagher says the Holy See stands ready to help South Sudanese end violence in their country. He says he has ever wanted to visit South Sudan ever since he became the Vatican's Secretary of Relations with States of the Vatican.
To see for myself what South Sudan is like, what the life is like for the South Sudanese, and to engage with the authorities. We have various meetings with leaders of the country and also with members of the churches, Christian churches. Not exactly a fact-finding mission, but to put some faces to the things that we read in reports and we see on in the media. Above that, whatever modest contribution we can make to the process that is underway here, we're happy to offer that.
The Archbishop visited the Catholic University of South Sudan in Juba and laid a foundation stone at the institution. He urged students there to participate in nation building, just as King David did in biblical times.
You too, my dear young friends, are called to build, so to speak, a temple, a sanctuary dedicated to life, that is, to build up your nation into a place where it is possible to live in dignity. To fulfill that role, I urge you, as David urged his son, apply yourself to your studies, and may the Lord be with you and prepare you for that great work which awaits you.
The Vatican diplomat also read out a list of questions written by Pope Francis while addressing a group of students at Catholic University of South Sudan.
How do we help our students to avoid seeing a degree as synonymous with a better position, as synonymous with more money and greater social prestige? They are not synonymous. Do we help them to see this preparation as a sign of a greater responsibility before the problems of today, before the needs of the poorest, before the care of the environment? It is not enough to make analyses and descriptions of reality. It is necessary to create space for true research, for debates that produce alternatives for the problems of today.
Pope Francis appointed Archbishop Hubertus Matthäus Maria van Meegen as the new apostolic nuncio for South Sudan in March 19, 2019. In 2017, leaders from Catholic, Anglican and Presbyterian churches in South Sudan invited Pope Francis to visit the country, but the Vatican cancelled the pontiff's trip over security and logistical concerns. Last week, the pontiff told President Kiir during his visit to the Vatican that he still plans to visit South Sudan. The audio in this story was courtesy of Marco Lugel, a journalist with Bakita Radio in Juba. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Civilians who are returning to Malakal town to rebuild their houses after a peace deal was signed are also benefiting from International Committee of the Red Cross tracing program. The snapshot program at the protection of civilian sites have helped family members find loved ones who have been separated by the conflict. Dimo Silva Aurelio visited Malakal yesterday and has this report for VOA from Juba.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians who fled Malakal during the fighting that broke out in 2013 resettled at a UN Protection of Civilians site, while others escaped to neighboring villages. The town still bears the signs of South Sudan's 5 years of conflict. Bullet holes litter the walls of buildings still standing. The streets are desolate, but residents are slowly returning home. Some are refurbishing shops destroyed by fighting and starting their own businesses. International Committee of the Red Cross volunteers use handheld megaphones to raise awareness on the streets about the snapshots program for tracing family members. Relatives eager to find news about their loved ones often queue at the ICRC snapshot centers to have their photos taken or to identify their relatives from photos snapped at other camps across the country. Sebit Dak Ayok, who just returned to Malakal, says he has seen changes in his hometown.
This year there is a lot of improvement. Then you can see many people, they are coming outside. Some of them, they are going to run other businesses, what is called local businesses. So some of them, they come here in order to see their houses and then clean their houses. And some of them, they are still in the POC, and then they did not say that we are coming outside in order to stay here. So the life is normal here. And then what I realize, some of them, they want to come out, but majority their houses have been destroyed.
36-year Nyadel Udong Jack was separated from her brother in 2014 in Luakad village. She returned to Malakal from Khartoum last month. Speaking in Arabic, Jack says she is searching for her brother.
Forgot min shar.
Until now, I don't know his whereabouts. Only to hear recently that he is in a cob and he is fishing at the river bank. That is why I've come to look for him.
30-year-old Nyachenjok Unak fled the UN Protection of Civilians site since 2013 and got separated from her two children, Sarah and Bullish. She lost sight of them during fighting in 2013 when they were just 4 and 7 years old. Speaking in her native Shuluk language, Unak says she could not contain her joy when she learned her children made it out of the fighting alive.
When the war started in Malakal around 7 a.m., there was bombing and shelling, and everybody was frightened. And while I was collecting some belongings to flee out with, I found that my children have fled with other people to unknown location. I was sad and thought I would never find them, but I was praying to God to reunite me with them, and when I got them, I was very happy and excited.
The snapshot centers in Malakal give family members the chance to call or send messages to lost family members in hopes of tracing them down at other camps across the country. Lisa Patterson, the ICRC field coordinator in Malakal, says the snapshot program focuses on searching for relatives or minors separated from their loved ones during the conflict.
We see as the snapshot as one of the complementary tools to these beneficiaries' individual actions. But many beneficiaries will have challenges in their search, such as the economic factor, because if they don't have the money to take transport to their former communities, or perhaps go to Ethiopia, go to Sudan, to where they last heard their family member was living, this snapshot is a way of facilitating that search.
Despite all the pain the families encounter during wartime, Patterson says it is extremely rewarding to see South Sudanese being able to find lost relatives.
They may have lost their home, they have lost their livelihoods, all of their possession, but more often than not, their primary concern is what has happened to their family members. Are they well? Are they okay? And being able to have an answer to those questions, it's an enormous relief for the beneficiaries to know the fate of their loved ones. And so for ICRC, that is one of the key factors that we try and bring answers to beneficiaries about what has happened to their family members.
Last year, the ICRC, with the help of the South Sudan Red Cross, has facilitated more than 44,000 phone calls between family members separated by the conflict, exchanged 6,000 messages, and reunited 68 vulnerable persons, including children, with their families. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Education officials in SPLM-controlled part of Wau State are accusing government forces of continuing to occupy schools and denying children in that part of the country a chance to go back to school. The opposition shadow minister for education says nearly 30,000 students in the area are not attending school. VOA could not independently verify the SPLM-IO claims. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Wau.
Amancio Angelo Ungom, the SPLM-IO designated Minister for Education in Wau State, says South Sudan government soldiers are occupying schools in several parts, including Mboro, Besalia, Brinji, Ngobagari, Taban, and Wadalelo. Speaking in Arabic, Ungom says for the past 3 years, kids in opposition-controlled areas of the state have been prevented from attending school because soldiers have occupied their classrooms and other public buildings.
Their army took the advantage of the existing schools and occupied them. This is the big challenge for us, and we do not know how our kids are going to get their education. We are all aware that education is the future of every nation. Without education, we cannot move forward.
Ungom also says most parents in the area cannot afford to pay school fees. He says more than 10,000 school-age children in the greater Bagari area alone remain in the bush with their families. Rita Andrea Tito says her three children have not attended school since the conflict spread in Wau in 2016. Speaking in Arabic, Tito says even though the warring parties signed a peace deal last year, she still worries about the security situation with soldiers still occupying civilians' buildings.
Civilians will want to come and cultivate their farms, but how can they return to their villages if schools, health facilities, and churches are still occupied by the army? They wanted to come and cultivate, but as they come, they also wanted their kids to go to schools and access other services.
Musa Joseph Ugali, a traditional chief in the rebel-controlled area of Ngisa, says civilians worry about their kids' future. Speaking in Arabic, Ugali says the warring parties should implement the peace agreement in good faith so that children can go back to school.
Our citizens have become the victim of the war. As Proverbs say, when two elephants are fighting, grass suffer. I only see one solution for this problem. The government forces should evacuate the buildings and go to their barracks. We also need the opposition forces to go to their respective containment areas, according to the peace agreement.
South Sudan government military spokesman Major General Lul Roy Kwong says he does not know anything about government soldiers occupying Wau buildings.
I'm not aware of a formal request put across by concerned authorities about the need for our security forces to take the place that they are said they are occupying. No formal complaint has been brought to us. I'm not aware of any formal request made for us to vacate in any good reason for us not to comply.
The ceasefire and transitional security arrangements, monitoring and verification mechanisms, which is tasked with monitoring compliance by the warring parties and armed groups on the peace agreement, was not immediately available to verify this claim. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at a move by South Sudan government to ban bleaching products. Find out more when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you more of a spender or a saver?
I am more of a spender because I like to do steady business, buying and selling quick ones than to be paid monthly.
I save a lot. I'm a saver because mostly when I want to get something, I have to keep money for a very long time to get it. So I don't always spend money. I save and then plan ahead.
I must learn from now how to save money because maybe in future I will be a governor, so that I can know how to save money for my country.
I'll be more of a saver, but I can't save what I don't earn. And you're also an African, really. You see how income and expenditure works. You see our budgeting style that our economy has. That is why I'm not in a suit.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan became the latest country to ban skin bleaching products in January, joining Cote d'Ivoire, Rwanda, South Africa, and Ghana. But as Ayen Bior explains, banning these products in some countries seem to be not working.
South Sudanese activist Nyamaltu Diel, who has dark skin, was pressured by peers to bleach her skin to a lighter tone when she was in high school. She says she knew better.
In our community, they often say that, you know, just lighten yourself a little bit. You'll just be so much prettier if you just, you know, open up a little bit, just brown it. People are like, you know, I have this lotion, it only has 2% hydrocodone. I'm like, yeah, I'm okay.
Her home country, South Sudan, announced a ban on skin bleaching products in January, with officials citing health concerns. Some skin lightening products have hydroquinone, corticosteroids, and mercury, some of their main ingredients which can be harmful to your health. Symptoms can include mercury poisoning, kidney failure, and cancer. South Sudan follows other countries that have banned harmful products. In 2016, Ghana's Food and Drugs Authority declared skin bleaching a public safety issue and banned products containing hydroquinone, a toxic skin lightening agent. Rwanda's health ministry announced in January that it would enforce a ban on skin bleaching products, and the ministry's director of cancer unit, Francois Uwinkindi, says it's part of a multifaceted effort to curb their use.
We are now putting much efforts, like educating people, going around and selling those illegal products. So you can say that we are also joining those other countries that are also in this fight of the use of those skin-lightening cosmetics.
But Kigali resident Sifa Gaudence is defying the ban, saying she will find alternative ways to purchase them.
I'm very sad that these products have been banned. We'll just use what's locally available, but people who made that decision need to know that these products make a woman feel beautiful.
Another Kigali resident, Agne Amiwana, echoes those remarks. She says she has been lightening her skin for 7 years to make herself more attractive to her husband, who prefers light-skinned women.
If I don't have these products, I'm afraid I'll become too dark like I used to be. I still have a few products left, but I hate the thought of becoming darker.
Tutdeel says skin bleaching is a symptom of widespread discrimination against people on the basis of the shade of their skin tone. Some say this issue, referred to as colorism, has unfairly targeted darker-skinned people across the continent.
Black is not just one thing. Black is different shades. We could be as light as an albino person and as dark as I am. And that's a beautiful thing.
She says people should not change themselves, but should try to change the system that discriminates against dark-skinned people. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
Soccer clubs in the English-speaking region of Cameroon are relocating to safer areas after a coach and players from University Club were abducted by suspected separatists. The military says it has arrested at least 10 suspected kidnappers, but players say the abduction shows the government is unable to protect its citizens. Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from the town of Bamenda.
These are players of Bang Bullet Football Club of Nkambe, a second division team training in Kwen, a neighborhood in Cameroon's English-speaking northwestern town of Bamenda. Team manager Ndi Eugene says the squad abandoned its base in Kambe, 160 kilometers to the north, when some players were taken hostage by separatists and the team president threatened for taking part in Cameroon's soccer competitions.
We started reading trauma in players and in coaches. It's not easy. What we have in Kambe as a fan base, what we have as community support and everything, we cannot have it in Bamenda. But we'll continue with the game. Football knows no politics, so football should rather be used to get us all together.
Even in Bamenda, a town they consider safe, the team has continued to receive threats, Ndi said. The danger was made clear this week when Dumbe Bosso, the head coach of Young Sports Academy team, was abducted by separatists and released fewer than 24 hours after. On Wednesday, 20 students of the University of Boya football team in the English-speaking Southwest region were kidnapped, severely tortured and released 24 hours after their kidnapping. Football associations in the English-speaking regions say activity has fallen by 75%, with at least 60 teams not playing. Many fans fear to go to pitches. In a statement circulated on social media, people claiming to be separatists warned teams from the northwest and southwest not to participate in championships organized by the central government in Yaoundé. They also asked teams from the 8 French-speaking regions of Cameroon not to play any matches in the 2 English-speaking regions. Deben Chofo, governor of the northwest region, tried to assure the public that enough security is in place to protect all citizens and the players. He did, however, call on people to help the government by reporting suspected separatists. Sports analyst and former player Jean-Pierre Ekoto explains why the separatists target football teams.
Au Cameroun, le football est un sport que la population aime.
He says the separatists know that in Cameroon, sports, especially football, is a very popular game that unites so many people, and stopping it by kidnapping players may push many people, both English and French speakers, to revolt. And the international community will add pressure to the government to pay more attention to solving the crisis in the restive regions. The separatists launched a campaign in 2016 to win independence for the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
From Bamenda, we move to Uganda, where authorities in Kampala on Thursday launched the China-built Isimba hydropower dam in the country's east. The $568 million dam is expected to improve access to power in Uganda, where less than 30% of the population have electricity. But as Halima Athumani reports from Kayunga, the dam is not without controversy and has come at a price for the local people and ecology.
Up the shores of Victorian Nile River, local women do their laundry, bathe and collect water for use at home. It is for many locals their only source of water, but soon their gatherings here will no longer be possible. Upstream, the just completed $568 million Isimba hydropower dam crosses 4 districts in eastern Uganda, including theirs. fishermen are busy digging a fence to close access to the river. It is a river that families depend on, says local resident Diana Namuli. She says their children would swim whenever they want, but that's not going to be possible. As a mother, I would send my child to fetch water, says Namuli. That's not going to be possible. They open the water 24 hours and this place floods, she says. The dam constructed by China International Water and Electric Corporation will increase electricity access to the less than 30% of Ugandans who have it and cut power costs. But it has come at a price for the local ecology as well. Before the dam, this Uganda part of the Nile River brought tourists to its waterfalls and wildlife. Visitors came here to see red-tailed monkeys and endangered pangolins, among others. At the official launch of the dam Thursday, officials acknowledged choosing 183 megawatts of clean power over access to water and natural beauty. Simon Kasiate is spokesman for the Uganda Electricity Generating Company.
It's been a delicate balance for government, but we have to make that choice. And therefore, with the coming in place of this hydropower station, it meant that, of course, would disrupt the social setting up of the communities around. Where someone walked to their little jerrycan and fetched water off a stream, now you have got a reservoir, which is a lake. Where someone simply walked through and crossed to visit their kith and kin across the river, now we have a hydropower station that has its own restrictions because of the safety nature and the safety considerations that we put around.
Critics say China's infrastructure projects in Africa increase Beijing's influence on the continent, along with African debt. China's ambassador to Uganda, Zeng Zhuqiang, calls the allegations groundless.
On the contrary, in pursuing cooperation, China values sincerity, friendship, and equality, pursue common interests, win-win cooperation, and put friendship first.
In addition to the Isimba Dam, China is also financing the $2 billion 600 megawatt Karuma hydropower dam in northern Uganda. Once active, the two hydropower dams will nearly double Uganda's power supply. Uganda's future generations will see if the electricity is worth the cost. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kayunga, Uganda.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Abye by the group Abye Jazz Band. We have been listening to Abye Jazz Band with the song Abye. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a safe weekend, everyone. We'll meet you back here next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.